It's The Wonky Show. We're talking duty of care, international students, and drugs. It's all coming up.
I don't think universities should be dealing with clinical cases of, say, suicidal ideation. I don't think that should come into a duty of care. And that's not because I'm saying, oh, they're not experts, leave it to the experts, because universities are filled with experts. But I'm saying that because if you look at the student condition, well, actually, if you look at...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to survey the perimeters of HE policy this week are three brilliant guests, as always. In Bath, it's Sue Rigby, Vice-Chancellor at Bath Spa University. Sue, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. A highlight of the week, we've just finished our staff survey and 82% of people who work for Bath Spa University would recommend it to a friend. I'm not sure what they'd recommend it to a friend for, but I'm just delighted by that number.
And in Cheltenham, it's Andy Yule, Executive Director of Digital and Regulation at the University College of Estate Management. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is finally getting some thoughts published around data burden. It's perhaps a bit geeky. They've been gnawing at my brain for ages, and I'm really pleased to get them out there and start to get some response, which has been fantastic.
Yes, you read about that on wonky.com. And in sunny Brighton, it's Sunday Blake, Wonky's Associate Editor. Sunday, your heart of the week, please.
This is a preemptive one, but tonight we are starting our first in a series of focus groups on curriculum transformation with deans, and I'm really excited about that because I love running focus groups, because there's so much like expertise and insight in our students, partners, academics, professional service staff, and I always come away just filled with new ideas, so really looking forward to that.
So we start the week with a petition and a big conversation about universities' duty of care. Andy, walk us through it, please.
So there has been a petition to Parliament, 128,000 signatures calling on the government to legislate for a statutory legal duty of care for universities towards students. It's been discussed by the Parliament in Parliament by the Petitions Committee, and there was an evidence session on Tuesday where we heard from the petition creators, student and university representatives. So, I mean, obviously, this is such a difficult issue, and there's so much emotion and difficult issues tied up with it. Relatives of students who had died by suicide outlined how universities had not communicated with families and really sort of raised this issue that there was just not consistency across the sector. And while there was recognition that the sector does so many good things and there were so many initiatives and good practice in place out there, there is a feeling that, you know, students continue to fall through the gaps on some of these things. UUK and Amoshi argued that, you know, unlike schools, universities really only have a limited impact on students' wider lives. It's a far more, I guess, complicated relationship than it is with something like a school. And there is a huge risk that further sort of regulation and legislation in this area is actually going to be a real disincentive for staff to come into the sector and engage with these issues. So, look, you know, a tremendously difficult subject, so many angles on this, but, you know, such an interesting debate to start the show with.
So, I want to start with you, Sue. I mean, this is extremely complicated and quite difficult on many fronts. It seems to me that this fundamental question about universities' duty of care towards students is becoming kind of one of the totemic issues of our time, in that it's not settled at all, and also a lot seems up for discussion, and a big sort of mismatch, I think, between public understanding and how the sector thinks about it.
Yes, I think it's one of the most difficult topics that I've come across in 5 years as being a Vice-Chancellor. I was actually astonished when a judge ruled that we didn't have a duty of care towards students, because I think we do. The Department of Education thinks that we do. Changing something that's implied by health and safety legislation into something statutory might be a useful way to go, but what struck me, I mean, full credit to the folks who raised this petition. I mean, listening to the petition committee hearing was one of the hardest listens I've done for the last few years, and the emotion and the sort of valid anger in the room was palpable. But what was also very clear was that every petitioner had a very different view of what an implemented statutory legal duty of care would achieve. And I think it's time to stand back now. I think universities have to stop being defensive about this. But I also think that we have to look very clearly at what we can be expected to do and what goes outside, what we would extend to our employees, that we would extend to people who visit campus for other reasons. And I think the other piece of critical information is the ONS information about the rate of deaths by suicide, which are something like 3.9 deaths per 100,000 students, 12.5 deaths per 100,000 general population. So arguably, universities are already doing an awful lot that is having an effect. But equally, every time there is a failure, those are lives destroyed. And that's an unbearable conundrum to live with.
Mm. I was going to come on to that legal case later, but since you mentioned it, I think, I mean, if Jim's written a fair amount of this on the site, there is an appeal against it and a sense that the sector is waiting for the outcomes of an appeal to kind of issue its own guidance about what to do in these sorts of cases. And it is a complicated one, and we'll put links in the show notes as well, because we don't have time to kind of go through all the ins and outs right now. But I guess my question just on that case, sir, is or the fallout from it is, if what you're saying is right, then is there a way, I guess, for the sector to be less defensive and to say, well, you know, it isn't a question of what happens in an individual case and the precedent from it, but you know, perhaps there's something proactive to be done. Steve West talked about a care excellence framework, which I don't know if it's a serious suggestion, but it's an interesting one, and obviously raises some interesting questions, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, we do have a regulator. I'll just leave a moment to pause there for listeners to make of it what they wish. And it could well be that it is through that regulation, but we also have that wider duty of care that society imposes on us. And I suspect that that's the place to visit. I think universities are defensive because we can't comment on individual cases. But understandably, parents and relatives who've been affected by this are very invested in looking to blame universities for what's gone on. And I'm not for a minute suggesting that there isn't in every case an element of blame, but the inequality of that in terms of the emotional response and the duty of silence on one party tends to lead to an outcome of defensiveness. And I suspect that the solution is to, in a sense, drain the emotion away from this and look from a legal context at what it's reasonable for a university to do. And that might well be different for a mature student living at home compared to a student living in halls of residence that are owned by a university on its own campus. There may have to be a variety of solutions or variety of different levels of care being implemented. We also have to allow for students who are estranged from their parents, or where extended contact with parents, if a student becomes upset, might actually lead to adverse consequences. But again, as I say that, I can feel the defensiveness in what I'm saying. And I think we have to just take all of that apart now and say, from bottom up, from a sort of foundation of an intention of care, what should universities do and how do we best impose that requirement on them? I suspect we'd find that most universities already do it, but I think that that's something that we should subject to objective testing rather than just kind of hoping for the best. And then I think you lay on top of that enhancements that come from, for example, and I would say this, wouldn't I, the Student Minds University Mental Health Charter and so on, where you can go above baseline. But I think that that general duty of care is the baseline, and I'd hope that most universities exceed it already.
Sunday, you've been following this closely, obviously, for Wonky. Is there something to be done to bridge that gap between the public perception, the people who signed that petition, particularly the leaders of that, the bereaved families, and the sector, where it does feel like a kind of gulf has opened up, doesn't it? And what can I guess from from our side and in terms of the sector side, where, you know, where can bridges be built while, you know, while there is still quite a lot pending in terms of the outcome of those legal, you know, legal cases, etc., mm-hmm. etc.?
Yeah, no, this is actually really interesting, and it's something I'm going to try and talk about succinctly, but also with clarity, because it is something that it is, well, like Andy said, it's just really difficult to talk about. I thought it was really interesting that Sue said that there are different views, you know, internally, externally to the sector about what should be happening and different ideas about, you know, what a duty of care would achieve. And different ideas even come in from petitioners and witnesses as well. And that really spoke to me, because I don't actually know what the petition wants universities to be doing. Because what was really interesting was in the government's response, they said, they specified that providers do actually have a duty of care already. And that can be summed up as providers owing a duty of care to not cause harm to their students through the university's own actions, which is a line that I've always taken, by the way, that, you know, wellbeing initiatives should be there to counteract distress caused by university experience. So, for example, stressful exams, how to manage exam stress, and sort of low level intervention like CBT. But I think what, like, there needs to be a sort of public understanding of what universities can do, but also what they can do that could actually cause further harm. Because I don't think universities should be dealing with clinical cases of, say, suicidal ideation. I don't think that should come into a duty of care. And that's not because I'm saying, oh, they're not experts, leave it to the experts, because universities are filled with experts. But I'm saying that because if you look at the student condition, well, actually, if you look at mental health conditions, complex ones, suicidality manifests in very complex conditions that can range from 2 to 10 years to treat. And I think if universities start wading in on this kind of clinical treatment, which is what some of the conversation is suggesting, say a third year engages with that treatment and then graduates within 6 months, that therapeutic process is disrupted. They lose all their support and they're at the bottom of a very long NHS waiting list as a graduate, and a waiting list that they could have been at the top of and engaging with treatment if they had not been sort of, if the responsibility had not been put on the university. And I think that, and remember that as well, graduate suicide rates are at a higher rate than student suicides. And of course, every suicide is tragic, but this is an even more vulnerable time for them to be using support. So I kind of feel that rather than focusing on universities, it would be within the petitioners, the public, you know, universities themselves' interest to be looking at how difficult it is to be a transient patient within the NHS. You know, students moving up and down the country, they can't register at 2 different doctor surgeries. This means the reality is that a student with a severe mental health condition is going to spend like weeks and weeks of a vacation period or a term period, depending where they're registered, not supported by their assigned primary or secondary care team. And the solution to that, in my opinion, is not to sort of ratify what universities should be doing, but looking at where the gaps in primary and secondary NHS care are happening and how students are falling through those gaps just because of the reality of the student transient experience.
Let's pick up some of those themes. I think that, you know, clearly that there are issues with NHS and the kind of general public health policy that has led to some of the kind of gaps in the system that students and graduates to some extent can fall through for the reasons that Sunday set out. And I guess I'm wondering whether this is an area that could be more fruitful for universities to work on in terms of its, you know, the universities already have very significant partnerships across the NHS, and also significant clout in terms of, you know, policy making, given that, you know, major stakeholders of, you know, a lot of where, you know, health policy is driven from, where, you know, health services are commissioned from. So I wonder, I guess the question to Andy is, you know, what more could the sector be doing if it points its sort of fire that way?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a rich seam in that, isn't there? And building on what Sunday says, there is something significant about partnerships. And, you know, Mark, you mentioned sort of the NHS angle and partnerships around that. And, you know, another angle on partnerships is something that we do an awful lot of at UCM. We have an awful lot of apprentices, you know, students studying a degree as a part of an apprenticeship. And, you know, that is a relationship with the HE provider and the employer. And, you know, there is potential for us to be, as a sector, I think, far more joined up and coherent in many ways. I think Sunday's absolutely right. You know, there's a sense in which we need to stop thinking of this as an issue about higher education. It is a far broader issue across society. It is, yeah, particularly that thing about transitions as individuals move from one status to a different status and move geographically around the country. I think there's something about the framing of this whole thing, this whole debate about, you know, the role of universities. It's actually broader about the role of universities in the contribution they can make to the broader debate around this. And you know, we have to work together. We have to look outside HE to find the broader solutions to this.
I think Andy's quite right. And I think Mark, you're sort of, and Sunday, you're getting to the root of this problem. As a society, we have to start talking about suicide, and we have to start talking much more openly about mental health issues. We can't contain that within a university, and we have to work in partnership with parents, because otherwise there's this implication that once a student enters a university, they're entering a bubble where they can expect to be completely safe. And then at the end of it, they leave the bubble. And even if we've achieved complete safety in it, we've not kitted people out to be serviced by society more widely, by the NHS or other support networks at exit. But equally, what we're looking at is an NHS that is unable to deal with these students. We had a case recently where we called an ambulance. A student was in great distress. They were taken to A&E. They were identified as needing residential help. None was available. They were returned to the Hall of Residence. The best thing that happened was that the NHS told us as a university that that had happened. But while you've got that level of disconnect in care, there are going to be tragedies. And I'm not for a minute saying that that's the only causality, but we are part of a larger system that is letting society down when it comes to mental health and well-being. And that's that has to be a main focus of the work to remediate this across society, not just for people who are lucky enough to be university students, I think.
I mean, this is slightly tangential, but one thing that I did think was important to raise was that there's a lot of focus on institutions declaring the number of annual suicides that occur. And that is a suggestion that really concerns me, because we have a very large and complex sector, and the demographics of institutions vary so much that if that was to become mandatory, it could favour more sort of like middle class institutions or whatever the demographic is. If an institution has a demographic which is more vulnerable to successful suicide attempts, so the the Office for National Statistics site that the government's response to the petition was getting its stats from, it also says that the sort of highest age bracket is 45 to 49, and the highest sort of region is the Northeast. And I completely understand why people think it's important, because they think that it would show negligence at certain institutions. But actually, if an institution has a higher rate of, say, mature students that are falling into that demographic of higher suicide rate, it's going to look as if the institution is at fault, when actually that institution just has a different demographic to, say, perhaps a Russell Group University in the South, which has, you know, more of a privately educated middle class demographic who, you know, may even have access to private healthcare and that sort of thing. So I really do understand this need for accountability, but we have such a diverse and complex sector that I don't think that would give us an accurate insight to what universities are doing.
Hmm. So I'm conscious we've been talking about this for a while. This is because it is really interesting and really complicated. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Mark Peace. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the sector's relationship with experiential learning. In the article, I reflect on how concepts like application, co-construction and work integration are now core to many of the sector's education strategies. I think this is exciting, with potential to support new practice that impacts beyond student employability and into authenticity, belonging and agency. But there's also a risk of viewing experiential learning as a quick fix to complex challenges. Drop students in at one end and they emerge at the other having somehow core employable. To counterbalance this urge, I argue that we need to crack open this black box of experiential learning and think carefully about the nature of the transformations we aim to deliver. In doing so, we can find innovative and more scalable ways of configuring these impacts and develop the scaffolds needed to ensure that every student can benefit from them. We're supporting this with a symposium and sector institute to bring together senior leaders and leading practitioners in order to push forward the art of the possible in this exciting area.
Okay, so another row about international students is happening in Whitehall Sunday. Talk us through it.
Yes, so the Department of Education, Home Office and Treasury are apparently finalising a plan that would stop dependents travelling with master's students on one-year courses. And allegedly, Home Secretary Suella Braverman is becoming increasingly frustrated that some of her proposals to reduce total migration to the UK are being opposed by other members of the cabinet. Sorry, not the panel. And a quick refresh. So these proposals include reducing the time foreign students can stay in the country after their course, known as the graduate route, as well as plans to block low quality courses or providers from recruiting international students. And there is a big question mark and ministerial concerns about whether this could lead the government to legal challenges. And meanwhile, this week, we actually got new estimates for the economic benefit that international students bring to the wider UK economy. So it's risen from 31.3 billion in 2018 to 19 to 41.9 billion in 2021-22. And this was in new modelling from London Economics, which takes into account tuition fee income, living expenditure and other income. Overall, the net benefit to the economy that the 2021-22 cohort of international students are expected to bring over the course of their studies is estimated at 37.4 billion. And the reason that's slightly lower than 41.9 is because they deduct the total public cost, so like healthcare, housing and school education for children associated with the international students. The net economic impact per student is said to be 125,000 per EU domiciled student and 96,000 per non-EU student. And that difference is ascribed to EU students being more likely to take undergraduate degrees. So they're in the country longer and more likely to spend money.
So, right. So from the sector's point of view, Sue, I mean, I guess the kind of the least worst option is the one that looks like they're landing on, which is this crackdown on PGT dependence. But there are these other things on the table, aren't there? Like the idea that it would block quote unquote low quality courses and providers from recruiting international students, which has been talked about for years, but has never made any sense. And they've never been able to explain how that would actually work. But there is, you know, there is a move afoot, and there's, I mean, despite the benefits that Sunday set out, there is a case to say that, you know, the international students have contributed to a big jump in net migration, and there are concerns about that in, you know, wider society.
I think it's very fair to question why we want international students. I'm old enough to remember when this was all about soft power, and we felt that we could educate the world, and in doing so, we could instill it with British values. But the British values that I see now are that you take a really, really successful industry that's financially beneficial to the UK, and you dismember it because there is a statistic that rests at the end of it that looks worse because of this enormously successful industry. Students are net migrants for a very, very limited amount of time. And then they go back to their country of origin, kitted out by our education. The obvious thing to do is remove them from the statistics of permanent migrants. And at that point, the problem goes away. This is an issue that makes me want to cry, because what you've asked universities to do is become successful businesses. They become successful businesses exporting education globally. And then the government starts to cavil about the fact that that means that international students visit us for a brief period of time. What do you want us to do is what I want to say in a kind of vile rage to ministers who are thinking about doing this. It makes no sense at all to me.
I guess putting in the case that, you know, Andy, that because of the incentives on universities to recruit international students to make up the shortfall in funding from home undergraduate students, some universities have done so almost too successfully, and now there's not enough housing, not enough services in some cases for all the students that are coming there, and when they've got dependents as well, that compounds the issue.
Yes, and of course, you know, the international student recruitment has been seen for many institutions as a way out of the immense pressures on funding, with the tuition fees stuck at now something around, what was it, around £6,000 of value that they were, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. So of course, yes, there's this great push to recruit international students. I think there's been some more data out from the OFS talking about, you know, worries about the extent to which the sector is becoming increasingly dependent, increasingly addicted perhaps to international student recruitment to just balance the books. And you're right, you know, it causes all sorts of problems on the ground with housing and other elements of provision. So it's a real conundrum. International student recruitment is obviously not equally spread across the sector. So, you know, any moves in the policy on this area is going to hit some institutions far harder than others. And I guess the other thing I do just want to reflect on is the extent to which and to sort of, you know, touched on it. This is just one strand in a far bigger issue about immigration, and, you know, the reasons for that. And there is a global issue about, you know, people being displaced from their homes. 26 million refugees, according to the UN, at the moment. And I just get the sense that higher education and this particular thing about international students, it's just collateral, it's political collateral as a part of a much bigger thing about you know, immigration and displaced individuals because of conflict, political instability, and of course the climate emergency and the extent to which, you know, some parts of the world are becoming uninhabitable and increasingly critical shortages of water everywhere. So, you know, this is a tiny bit of a much bigger and much more complex issue, but like Sue, I'm immensely frustrated by it. It's you know, why these we want students to come to the UK. It's a fantastic export. It's a success story. Huge frustration.
And I think despite all of this, as Andy says, it's a complicated issue, links to other things. This is the rhetoric that we get on, you know, as, you know, the government of the day, people talking about Braverman as, you know, potential future Tory leader, depending on what happens at the next election. There's a long term question here, isn't there, about I guess universities' consent that it has from the public and how many international students, you know, can come here. I guess statistics or no statistics, there is a point at which if it's felt, you know, regardless of the truth or not, that international students are taking the places of home students, then the sector is going to get into quite significant hot water, isn't it, Sue? Because particularly, you know, this rhetoric continues, one assumes it's also having some impact on how people think about these issues. There's a bit of a political minefield ahead, isn't there?
I think it's very tricky. But given that this government uses poor quality data so often to you have to say, attack universities. I mean, low quality courses in itself is one example of that. Then, you know, I think with expertise, you know, like Andy's, it's straightforward enough to start looking at how we remove these figures from the general issue and sequester them somewhere else. So if you think of these students as 41.9 billion quid's worth of income to the UK, rather than 120 odd thousand people who come here briefly, if you separate them from economic migrants or asylum seekers, because these are people who come and pay for the privilege of being here, you're better off allying them to tourists than you are allying them to economic refugees. These are valid people staying briefly in the UK in order to gain an education that they feel they can't gain somewhere else. Do we have to be careful? Yes, of course. We have to make sure that these students are properly looked after. We have to make sure that they have high quality accommodation. We have to make sure that their numbers don't impinge on the local environment around a university to its detriment. And we have to make sure that those are students that can integrate into the wider student population and gain the benefit from doing that. And also deliver benefit to home students by doing that. But the rhetoric around that should be the rhetoric of opportunity and not the fear that people will take again students. It's an old rhetoric that nobody wants students in their backyard. But actually no great harm comes from their being here. And I think that the opportunities for this are to embrace a global market that we've spent years trying to, in a sense, gain at the expense of Australia and the US, and having finally achieved that success, largely through the failure of the pound to retain its international value, it has to be said, thanks Tory government, having finally got this market, the idea that we shouldn't be allowed to keep it or we're addicted to it is just offensive and ridiculous, really. It's one of Britain's great success stories, and God knows there aren't many of those at the moment.
Obviously, there's been a recent uptake in numbers, which has sort of been pointed out as unexplainable. But, you know, it was very sort of public that the UK were thinking of banning dependents. So, you know, a sort of very quick uptake of international students and dependents sort of makes sense that people are fast tracking their plans for postgraduate study to come before that new rule. And I think the other thing is that, you know, there's some really kind of it's almost like conspiracy theories around this, where people are saying, I don't mind someone bringing, you know, their children, but people don't need to bring uncles and nieces, they don't need to bring them. And I think these comments are sort of made from this UK lens of family dynamics. Like, we don't tend to live in multi-generational households here the same way that some of the major countries we recruit from. And I think narrowing excusability down to spouses and children is sort of a little naive. Jim's done some really good work actually on the site, where he's looked at like the average birth rates for Nigerian women, and it's very normal for a Nigerian woman to have a child by the time she's 21. And I just think, you know, it's not a conspiracy if the age of the cohort that we tend to be recruiting from has a child. If that's a cultural norm, then that's a cultural norm. It's like, I always say, it's like going into a sixth form and being like, goodness me, why are all these 16-year-olds learning to drive? It's like, well, it's because it's a cultural norm for people. So 17-year-olds learning to drive, it's a cultural norm to be happening at that age. There's no conspiracy there. So I think I totally see why people are sort of saying, oh, look at all these dependents, what's happening? But if you actually situate it into a cultural context, it's a lot more banal and there's not really a conspiracy going on.
Now, university's approach to drugs has slightly ungenerously landed on the front pages this week. Sue, tell us why.
So this is the Times front page on Tuesday, with an investigation into student use of ketamine. Ketamine and some other more recently acquired drugs have been associated with a number of preventable student deaths. And in autumn 2020, as student drug use rose in the pandemic, we started to see the impact of this. The Home Office and the Department of Health and Social Care commissioned Dame Carol Black to look across the sector and across society at how to deal with this increasing drug use. And the detailed report that she produced is exceptionally useful and led to the creation of a Universities UK task force that has now reported on effectively a harm reduction approach to drug use in universities. Priti Patel has now jumped on this and is saying that universities will have blood on their hands because of the number of murders that take place with regard to drug crimes. I've not seen a lot of that at Basketball University, fortunately, but you never know. Perhaps she's right. I've not known it before, but you never know. And so what the Times is doing is reporting that there is a prevalence of drug use on campus, that universities are complicit in allowing drugs to be used on campus, that this is entirely contrary to what everybody in society wants, and that it's generally a very bad thing. And although the story is nominally about drugs, I think actually, and Sunday's done an excellent piece for Wonky on this, it's actually about how universities are victims of hostile coverage in the media for something that is actually quite a sensible idea. And I think, you know, in addition to looking at how we respond to young people experimenting in ways that push the boundaries of society's norms, we need to think about how universities finally come onto the front foot when it comes to looking after them and dealing with these issues.
Yeah, no, it was a hit piece. And I think there are two conversations to be had, actually three. I'll try and be quick with them. Obviously, the first is the initial article, which is just objectively awful journalism, and the writer making really broad assumptions about patterns of student drug use based off the price of drugs. And I understand why in like a sort of cost of living crisis he'd make that assumption, but there's a lot more going on, and it really showed how little there was that the, you know, investigative journalist knows about student drug use. But I did enjoy the comments under the article, and there are a few of them which were saying things like, I went to university 30 years ago, you know, this is nothing new. The second was an absolute character assassination of the student special advisor involved. And they really, really went for her. And she's a current student. She was completely discredited. Her work was discredited. And they even went as far as sort of posting a selfie of her that they had sort of taken from her social media. At a time she had like pink hair and piercings, and it was such a sort of transparent way of signaling to sort of middle class readers like, this is the wrong un. But what they didn't mention, as Sue said, is that she was the student special advisor, and they only mentioned her, but they didn't mention that the other special advisors were Professor Owen Bowden-Jones, who is the consultant addiction psychiatrist and chair of the Advisory Council on Misuse of Drugs, and of course Dame Carol Black, who authored the government-commissioned independent review of drugs, which is being used to inform the government's thinking on drug reform. So I don't know if someone wants to tell Priti Patel this. And they've left out those special advisors, and they've just included the student. And I think that you know, they sort of even talk about her student society that she runs, and it's just a student-run society of, it's literally just a group of students coming together and trying to sort of get better drug policy, and they've framed it as this sort of like sinister organization. And I think the other thing that's quite upset me and you know is quite horrible is that this student, in the same place that they, you know, went and got her pictures from, very publicly talks about the fact that her father passed away from an overdose during her time as a student, and that's why she got into drug policy reform. So not only was it misinformed journalism, I actually think that's quite nasty to do, to sort of leave out these vital pieces of information and frame her as somehow financially benefiting from students taking drugs. So yeah, there's a whole conversation about how students are, whether the sector means for them to be or not, used as cannon fodder and easy targets. But yeah, as you said, there's a wider conversation to be had around how the sector proactively frames and presents its own work to the public in order to be ahead of really bad narratives like this.
Well, it's in some ways not expected, I guess. It's just so not unexpected, rather, in that, you know, this is a, you know, this is an obvious opening for the culture war, for a new culture war. And I think every time the sector gets into these issues, it should probably expect it. But I guess, Andy, you know, what's, you know, I guess the important thing is, from the perspective of people who care about actual, you know, policymaking, the sector doesn't just completely run for cover when this stuff happens. It's got to plow on through, hasn't it?
Oh, it has, absolutely. And, you know, once again, this is a very complex issue that's boiled down to sort of, you know, simple, often political narratives. There are real strands between the issues we're talking about today, aren't there? I mean, the whole thing around, you know, student who die by suicide, and the idea that, you know, the sector really only can engage with this if we deal with other organisations and take it outside the sector. It's not just about HE. You know, the simple narratives around this and the whole immigration debate. It's once again, you know, the sector getting caught up in this thing. You know, yes, of course, drugs come and go. Yes, of course, you know, people were doing drugs 30 years ago, 50 years ago. And there's a really interesting broader picture here, isn't there? You know, we can look back on decades of drug policy that has failed in a variety of interesting and unusual ways, and you know we still live in a society where the drug that is the most damaging and causes the most harm to society is alcohol, and yet nobody is going to be shocked if I say I had a glass of Shiraz with my meal last night. And so, you know, there's a sense in which this is just depressingly familiar, but you're absolutely right. We have to engage with the debate. There is a sense in which we're on the back foot a little bit all the time, but it's broader than HE. You know, young people do drugs. That's arguably part of the whole thing of growing up, isn't it?
Well, Stuart, I mentioned on that point. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the mean streets of Bath Spa University. You're not exactly seeing the kind of the Priti Patel's nightmare vision, but I am interested in you know what your actual approach is on campus.
Our approach at Bath Spa is very much to look at reducing harm to any undergraduate or any student who chooses to take drugs, whilst at the same time having a whole series of policies that are very clear about our intention when it comes to students not engaging with illegal activity. And we have to keep that duality, but mainly I have to make sure that my students are as likely as possible to be well and healthy and informed. But beyond that, what I'm seeing is a much bigger issue that nobody is really talking about except in passing, which is that regardless of whether students take ketamine at the weekend, they are struggling to eat. And the main thing that we are doing on campus at the moment is producing subsidised meals. We are producing food lockers on campus so that people can help themselves for free to pasta and tomato, tins of tomato and baked beans and so on, because many of my students have to work more hours than they should in order to eat and have accommodation and stay warm. And that's the big issue that students are facing. It's not a university's approach to drug use, and it's actually not issues of mental health and well-being, though that's a very significant thing. Most students are worried about how they eat and how they sleep, and that's something that all of these articles and all of this toxicity in regard to what universities are doing elides. The main issue is something that isn't sexy enough to be the Times front page, but it's affecting the vast, vast majority of students in this country.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. And don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in the UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So, thanks very much to Sue, to Sunday, to Andy, and our news editor Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. In the meantime, stay wonky.